You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of the Cycling Podcast Feminan. It's our May episode. We are just really squeezing into May as close as possible. June is upon us now. And squeezing in with me is the lovely Denny Gray. Hello, Denny.
Hello, Rose. Virtually squeezing in today.
Virtually squeezing, yes.
Not sitting around the cabana, are we?
No, I know, which is exactly where we were last time. We were talking about the Spanish block of racing, which we'll be doing again this time. And always to be found in a cabana, of course, is Rebecca Charlton.
Thanks for having me back. I'm also sad we're not in the cabana, but I think we'll relive it soon.
Yes, I hope so. And I hope everyone can hear Rebecca because there is an ominous dangling cable coming out of her microphone. So... But we can just only presume that everyone can hear Rebecca. Otherwise, it's just going to be a third of the time it's going to be quiet. Might be a blessed relief. I don't know.
Thanks for the intro, Rose. Yeah. There is a dangling wire. I don't know what it's supposed to be connected to. So hopefully it's not my mic that's unplugged. As you can tell, I'm very tech savvy.
Now, I know also, Rebecca, you've been very busy as fan club president for Ninka Vinka, haven't you? We should just get onto that almost straight away.
I'm glad.
Because
I'm glad we always start with this.
Yes. Well, you've been on. Well, I'm just trying to, you know, explain the numerous empty Prosecco bottles that surround you there because you have been celebrating, haven't you, as fan club president?
It's been a big week of celebrations. She took the best young rider yet again, which is absolutely fantastic. I do want a little bit more from her Instagram. I keep a close eye on it. And actually, she hasn't really posted very much, but the one post she has done, she's delighted, of course, with how it's going. But one thing that, jokes aside, really, really stood out for me was actually her really driving, and we'll get onto this later, I'm sure, but really driving to try and bring back Capecchi. But being really critical in the duo trying to get back over in Burgos. So, yeah, we'll get onto that. But I think she's just been going from strength to strength. And, yeah, Prosecco corks have been popping.
Is that... I don't want to put more on your plate, Rebecca, but surely, you know, Ninka Vinka's social media presence, that's got to be... Does that not a little bit fall under your kind of role? Surely you need to start the fan club. You know how they always... Right. All these riders have fan club pages. I think that's actually... You are just kind of giving yourself another job there.
Yeah, I feel like... A newsletter, maybe, is on the horizon.
Maybe we should go old school. Maybe a telegram.
Work in
just
progress.
Take it back. Yeah. Well, see, it's something that, you know, you can work on. But yeah, I mean, Ninka Vinka was remarkable, wasn't she, in this Spanish block? And yeah, another... Oh, actually, I should tell you before we get too carried away with talking about the Spanish racing, I should mention what is coming up on the show, and that is our mini feature that we've got this month is about two Irish riders that are, you know, really having kind of making their breakthrough this year, should I say. You know, they might not have broken through just yet, but the future looks really bright for them. That's Lara Gillespie of UAE ADQ and Mia Griffin of Roland. Great to see a little bit more Irish presence also in the peloton, isn't it? But yeah, both of them are from the same Team Pursuit squad, a historic Team Pursuit squad, Ireland's first women's Team Pursuit squad to go to the Olympics. So they came from that and they're now, getting up there in top 10s in some of the fast finishes. So we'll hear from them later. But... Back to the cabana. Come back to the cabana with us, listeners, as we talk about this Spanish stage racing block, because it does, doesn't it, Denny, give us a little bit of an indicator of where everybody stands. You know, we kind of spend all the time classics talking about how everyone's getting on in the one-day races, and then we get to this little period, which is sort of between the Grand Tours, and we want to know how everyone's form is, who's riding for who, and it's given us a bit of an indication, hasn't it, so far?
Absolutely, yeah. We're firmly now in stage racing territory, aren't we? Having gone through the classics, three kind of world tour stage races in, and lots of kind of really interesting storylines appearing as a result. I think one that you touched on in your kind of Welter recap was the emergence of Marlon Reusser as a potential contender for this year's Tour de France Femme. And I think she proved that, didn't she, at Vuelta a Burgos, where she had a really, I guess, what I would say is a triumphant return, really, to stage racing after a real year of setbacks for her. After her crash last year, and then her second half of the season was written off due to a post-viral illness. It was a really commanding performance. And I know, you know, critics might say she wasn't up against some of her key potential rivals, but she looked incredibly strong all round, didn't she? She was opportunistic on stage two, finishing second ahead of a select group of contenders. She was then the dominant rider when climbing up Picon Blanco on stage three, and then won the TT. So back to kind of TT strength as well. She looked really formidable. And I think it's a really, really positive sign to see Marlon Reusser doing so well. And I think we all predicted that the loss of Damy Vollering would be a real dent to SD Works's stage racing credentials. But clearly losing Marlon Reusser too is another big blow. And it is interesting, actually, in this Spanish block, we've seen, you know, riders that were at SD Works last year doing so well, while SD Works' own contenders haven't fared so well, which I'm sure we'll come on to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an incredibly confident performance, wasn't it, Becca, from Marlon Reusser? Because, you know, as you touched on there, Denny, that we were saying, or maybe the great rivalry of Demi Vollering versus Anna van der Breggen is more of a Demi Vollering versus Anna van der Breggen versus Marlon Reusser triple rivalry. And she's kind of just proven that, hasn't she, at Burgos? And I think also it was so telling how much confidence she had as we've seen her go through the season. When she's come up against great rivals, she's often followed their lead or let them attack. Whereas in this, where she still had the likes of Elisa Longo-Borghini and Juliette Labousse there, and Lotta Kopecky was there, although not necessarily right, you know, up there in contention on that kind of summit finish on stage three, where Reusser went. But, you know, to have the confidence to think, actually, you know what, I think I might be the strongest legs here. I'm just gonna go for it.
Absolutely. She completely cemented that, didn't she? And yes, there is the caveat that Vollering wasn't there at Burgos, but like you say, there were some very, very big contenders she was up against, and she went and didn't look back. And I think I expected her to be good, but perhaps not that dominant. And I think it was incredibly telling from what, you know, we've said, looking at the later stage races in the season, Tour de France, Femme, Abegg-Zwift. I think it's immensely exciting. And you can see that confidence just building and building. She's already seen that she's been pretty close to Demi Vollering. And now I think what she did on those final two stages will just, as I say, just cement that. But I think one of the biggest talking points that I touched upon in the Arrive episode, and Denny, you've just mentioned, is I don't know that people are talking enough about how bad she had it last year in terms of adversity, and just how special it makes what she's doing now, because it adds so much context, I think. I think we'd be saying that this was remarkable, even if she'd had a brilliant year last year, but she had the ongoing illness and that really big crash that set her back so, so much. I mean, it was brutal at the time, her recovery from that. And I think she just had setback after setback. So I can only imagine how she feels coming into this year with the confidence of her teammates and that unit around her. And yeah, I think she's just pinching herself with how happy she is within that team fold as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she, after the finish on stage three, she did say she was shocked and surprised and delighted and couldn't imagine it going as well as it has. But it also shows that she's paying back the confidence that Movistar had in her, because for a team to sign her last year when she really was hardly able to do any racing at all, missing all of the kind of big targets that she'd had for the year, also, you know, not really tested as this kind of GC climber, you know, much more relied upon. Obviously, she got a few major wins at SD Works, but much more relied upon as a domestique, much more relied upon as a great time trialist, and also maybe a breakaway winner. But, you know, she would never have found the opportunity to be a leader in a stage race proper, like she has at Movistar. So she's really has kind of repaid the confidence they had in her, hasn't she, already?
Yeah, it was a real, it was a really good team performance from them as well, wasn't it? One of my memories from watching Burgos is Paola Patino kind of pacing her up the climb, up to Picon Blanco, doing a fantastic job. But also throughout the race, her teammates were on the front foot, chasing down breakaways, pacing her on the climbs. They put full confidence into her. And I think it was a real breakthrough moment for the team as a whole, because they hadn't won a stage race since Annemiek van Vleuten retired. And I think really it's a team that has been in that transition phase since he's disappeared from racing. And it feels this year like that team is now finding its feet. Leanna Lippert seems to be in great form. She had a great classic season. Marlon Reusser here kind of showing that she's got real stage racing legs. My favourite, Kat Ferguson, won the Navarra Classic recently, coming not quite a World Tour race, but a tremendous win in the rain from a kind of select group. They've been looking really, really strong. So I think that team will be carrying a lot of confidence now into the rest of the season, with some real kind of upcoming riders and some riders that, as you say, with Royce as the classic example, isn't it? You know, a rider with so much talent, and yet she's had to overcome so much. It shows that the team's been willing to back her and support her on her recovery.
Massively. Sorry, guys. I was just going to just add the fact that historically we know that somebody with impeccable strength, with that ability as a super domestique, with what we know she can do in a TT, it doesn't always translate to being a DC favourite, does it? You know, you have to have that perfect mindset, that ability to take on that role. And I think that's what speaks volumes as well, is she's just got every box ticked this season.
Yeah, she certainly does. I think also Movistar are kind of benefiting by having much clearer leaders now as well, aren't they? I mean, it does allow Kat Ferguson to go for a sprint finish, and it allows Leanna Lippert to do that slightly kind of difficult, slightly fast finish, but a harder race, slightly bumpy, hilly terrain. Whereas I think before, Movistar were really keen to get Leanna Lippert just to be their GC contender, because they felt like that she was one of the most talented. So I think having Marlon Reusser now allows everyone to play to their own strengths. Talking about playing to their own strengths, let's talk about SD Works, because, yeah, they have been, I mean, I would say looking a little bit ropey, aren't they, coming in ahead of kind of the Grand Tours that we've got. Anna van der Breggen, of course, was phenomenal at the Vuelta Femenina, which we talked about on the Arriva episode, but haven't spoken in a regular episode, getting a comeback stage win. But then she couldn't really mount much of a fight against Demi Vollering in the end there in the mountains, could she? And then Anna van der Breggen again in Itzulia, she crashed on the first stage, so we didn't get to, and then didn't start the next stage, so we didn't get to see her go up against Vollering there. And Capecchi at Vuelta a Burgos, because we've been so excited to see how Lotta Capecchi will fare as a GC rider. She came into Vuelta a Burgos very much as SD Works' chosen GC rider, didn't she? And then was kind of got stuck behind a crash, lost a bit of time on one stage, and then just came in sort of 2 minutes behind Marlon Reusser on that summit finish on the third stage. So, yeah, what are we thinking, Denny, about Lotta Capecchi, Anna van der Breggen, SD Works and their GC hopefuls?
Yeah, I mean, we're so used to seeing them as the dominant force in women's racing, stage races and classics alike. But I think what we've seen with this block of racing is that their aura of invincibility is definitely gone in stage racing now. I think they have been unlucky. Anna van der Breggen obviously had that crash at Itzulia, and she had to abandon with a kind of a wrist injury, which seems to be okay. So hopefully that won't affect her fitness going forward. But, and Lotta Capecchi was, of course, caught behind that crash. But I still think what it demonstrates is just the wider shifting of power, which we've kind of trumped up for so long. They'd been unbeatable in Itzulia until now. They'd won the general classification the previous 2 years and all of the stages. They started well with Misha Bredeveld winning the first two stages, but then, of course, Vollering, their former leader, kind of trumped Bredeveld and took the overall two. And I think that was a really kind of an important moment, really. It just showed really that things had shifted. I would say on Capecchi, she's had a difficult winter. She had a knee injury. You know, she missed some really important endurance work, and she hasn't raced that much this year, has she? She's done a few of the classics, but this was her first stage race. And so this
we say all this, but she did win the Tour of Flanders.
She won the Flanders, but even so, I think it was a great win, but even at the time, somehow we still felt she wasn't Capecchi at her best in the classic season. And I guess she almost won it despite not being quite at the top of her powers. And
wouldn't that be a great way to be?
It'd be all right, wouldn't it? It'd be all right.
Yeah.
But yeah, she, you know, this, she, I think she was treating this race as a test, and it, I guess it showed her where her form is. She's planning a big block of altitude training before the Tour de France Femmes. So I'm sure we'll see a different Lotte Capecchi come the Tour de France. So I think we shouldn't read too much into it, but certainly what it means to me, what it shows to me is that, yeah, the balance of power has completely shifted now, and it's all about FDJ now in the stage racing, and the other teams will be following their lead and hoping to pick up the pieces.
Yeah, I think that invincibility is definitely kind of gone, hasn't it, this season? And I have to agree with that sort of phrasing, Denny, of them facing quite bad luck. I do genuinely feel that, and I actually really feel for Capecchi at the moment. I'm kind of likening it in a way to what we saw with riders like Sir Mark Cavendish, who were just dominant, and then the moment they suffer injury or illness, it's like, ugh, they're done, the rubbish, you know. And I think she's spoken on her social media platforms about kind of having to deal with that criticism when you are obviously taking the weight on your shoulders, that you are going into everything as a massive favourite, and people do think you're superhuman and they do think you're invincible. And I think when I was watching Burgos and she got caught up in that crash and then had so much work to do, I still felt, well, this is Capecchi. She's just gonna, you know, teammates or not, she'll just ride herself back up. And then of course it became apparent it was way too much work to do. And again, that knee injury has obviously meant that she's not in the ideal place either. But I think another thing psychologically is she's very much put it out there, hasn't she, in terms of the transformations she's made over the last couple of seasons, looking more to being a GC favourite as well, a contender in that side of things. So I feel like once you've openly put that out there, there is also that mounting pressure as well. So it'll be really interesting to see in her head where she goes now or ahead of the Tour, because like you say, she's going into this block and she is such a determined rider that I imagine she'll channel that bad luck into doing even more.
Now, we know, Becca, that you feel for Lotte Capecchi at the moment. That's why you sent Ninka Vinka back, didn't you, to kind of try and bring her up to the front group on that summit finish?
Yeah, just hopped on that radio channel, got Ninka Vinka to go and ride for Capecchi. No, but as I very briefly touched upon earlier in our Ninka Vinka summary at the top of the show, it was really interesting to see actually just, yeah, how much work that she was doing there. And as I say, I thought they were doing a lot to bring it back, and then yeah, it was just too much ultimately.
Hello, Ned Bolting here. If you, like me, think that the journey is just as important as the destination, then can I interest you in my latest book, The Accidental Tourist? This memoir spreads its wings beyond the confines of just the Tour de France, as a quarter century of covering cycling takes me all around the world, following skinny men and women racing bikes very fast. There's chapters on life at the Giro, the growth of women's racing, and memories of Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. The Accidental Tourist is out now and available from all good bookshops and audiobook retailers.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Now, I know you're both kind of saying that, you know, SD Works have had a lot of bad luck, and I don't want to disagree. That would be mad for me to disagree with that, surely. But I do want to bring something up, which is that time and time again, I just felt like it was history repeating. When I saw Lotta Kopecky getting caught behind a crash and losing a bit of time there, and SD Works had one of their riders, Femke Markus, in the front group, and they didn't send Femke Markus back for a very long time to go and help bring Lotta Kopecky back, so she didn't lose loads of times on GC. I was just thinking, you know, is this sort of team orders or what is going on here? Because obviously we saw that most famously at the Tour de France, didn't we, with Demi Vollering in yellow, you know, flat out on the floor, and all of her teammates just cycling past her, and Blanca Vas going for the win on the stage, and yet, you know, losing the yellow jersey there in the process. So either SD Works haven't learned their lesson from that, or the team tactic is, you know, we go for the win at all costs and we don't worry about our leaders. I don't know. Denny, what was your read on that situation?
I mean, I guess the generous look at it is it's a little bit of a blind spot for the team. It does seem to be a coincidence, doesn't it, that they've got designated leaders and yet they're not demonstrating to us as watching on TV that they're putting all their riders behind that team leader at key moments. You know, we saw that in the Tour last year, and I guess we read into that's just part of the Demi Vollering saga that was going on at the time. But it did seem odd that happened, and it also happened in Itzulia as well, where Van der Breggen crashed. The team still had riders in the front group, and that was maybe a difficult call for them because they were going for that stage for Misha Bredevold to win. But again, you know, there was a moment where they could have dropped their riders back and thought, well, actually, we're riding for Anna van der Breggen here. We need to protect her. She ended up having to abandon anyway. So in some ways, it was academic. But at the time, that was a call that they decided not to make. And Misha Bredevold said afterwards that she didn't know about Anna van der Breggen's crash until after the stage, which again just seems odd. You know, what's going on in the team car radio? You know, what are they communicating? We don't know the answers, but it just does seem a little bit odd from the outside.
That reminds me of that Lorena Vibus quote, wasn't it? When it was Lorena Vibus, I think, that went past Demi Vollering, who was on the floor, and she said, "Oh, I thought I saw something yellow on the floor." Oh yeah, that's your teammate and the leader of this very prestigious race that you just sidled on past. But yeah, no, it is intriguing, isn't it, Becca? I mean, I guess they don't necessarily need to. They have had for so long so many champions in their squad and so many ways of winning almost every single race. I feel like it's a little bit survival of the fittest out there. And we kind of saw that on that famous Strada Bianchi, again, which sort of fed into the whole Vollering Kopecky saga, didn't it? When Vollering and Kopecky went for it, they were both teammates and they were going for the Strada Bianchi, and they were both surprised that the other one was accelerating towards the finish line and not, you know, gifting them the win. But it's kind of this great narrative that we like to have about SD Works, but maybe they just got too used to winning everything and in every single way.
I guess that's the thing, isn't it? In the really high profile scenarios we've looked at there, is that they had, you know, they had the potential and actually did go on to get the stage win. So like you say, is it, you know, maybe it would be a completely different conversation if they hadn't pulled off the win and they'd also abandoned their GC favourite. But I guess, you know, there is that argument that, well, they took the stage, so maybe that was the plan. But I was quite happy to let Denny fly on his take there, because, you know, I love it when we get onto the controversy or potential controversial chat. But I think I think they have had so many cards to play in so many scenarios that it's really difficult to know what's being communicated. And I actually spoke to, after the Demi Vollering saga with Vass going for the win, I spoke to a couple of director sportifs from other teams to get their honest take about what they thought had happened there. And it was really conflicting in terms of what people thought, actually. And of course, they themselves wouldn't have been on that team radio, but they are to their team. And they were sort of saying, actually, it's very easy to think, oh gosh, well, she's done that and she's made that decision. But actually, it all happens so fast, especially with, you know, not that many kilometers to go to the finish. Then actually I was talking to Sean Clark from Live Leader Jayco, and he was saying at the time that actually he didn't think it was controversial. He thought that there were genuine mistakes made in terms of just not knowing the severity or not knowing they needed to change a plan or go back. So I think for a DS to honestly say, well, you don't always know looking on how difficult it was to make a judgment call in that split second of what happened. But obviously us watching at home from a distance with an aerial view of Vollering on the floor in that scenario, it was very easy to criticise. So I feel like, as usual, I've ended up on the fence because I've spoken to people that are like, absolutely, how on earth did they get it so wrong? And other people going, it's a bike race, it's huge, it's the Tour, these things happen, it's all in a split second.
Yeah, and I guess what we have to appreciate as well is that the directors aren't saying things in real time. They might not even be getting the information, you know, a few seconds later, depending on what the reception is they're getting in the car. They you know, the race radio communications might not be telling them immediately that their rider's down. And in that particular instance in Burgos, of course, you had UAE and Longo Borghini absolutely driving it on the front. And it must have been quite, you know, which some people might criticize that team for, but It must have been a chaotic situation for the riders from SD Works left in that bunch, because they were having just to react to what was going on around them and not necessarily knowing who was caught behind. So I do take that, but it just feels like that. It seems to be happening, you know, more than when it happens kind of three times, you do start to wonder whether there's anything they could do better in that regard. But who knows? Maybe it's just all innocent mistakes.
And you think they would appraise that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if we could move on from last year's tour.
Sorry, Max.
back to this season. Joking aside, let's talk about one of the big breakthrough performances. Because I would say Mia Bjørndal Otterstad, her stage win over Marlon Reusser at the Vuelta a Burgos on the second stage. I think that was a huge moment, not for her, but also for Uno X, her team. She's been with that team since they began. I think it was back in 2022. She's kind of been on their roster. And I think, I was going back, and I think this was also the first World Tour win for Uno X. So that might be incorrect, but I'm pretty sure it's the first kind of World Tour win for them. Certainly the first World Tour win for her, but great to see other riders coming up. And also she put up such a great fight to hold on to that leader's jersey, didn't she, on that stage three, on that kind of big climb on stage three, didn't she, Denny?
Yeah, it was a real breakthrough moment for her, wasn't it? And she's 27 now, and she hasn't, that's definitely her first World Tour win. We need Lizzie Banks fact checking whether that's the team's first World Tour win, but she's, you know, she's won other things before. She won the Tour de Normandy last year, and came third at the Santos Tour Down Under this year. So she's clearly, you know, shown before that she can compete with the best and do well in stage races. But that was a great opportunistic win from her, and it was great to see a team like Uno X taking a World Tour win. We talk too much, I think, about SD Works and FDJ and the other big teams, but it's always great to see kind of teams, riders from the lesser teams, if I'm allowed to call Uno X that, win a race. And yeah, as you say, it's really what I find fascinating and really uplifting about wins like that is, as you say, Rose, it then seems to inspire those riders, gives them so much more confidence. And we saw that in her defense of the leader's jersey, didn't we? And hopefully we'll see it again later on in the season. You know, now she's got her first win in the World Tour, she may have more confidence, and we may see her at the front end of racing again later this year.
I think that's also a little bit one of the byproducts of having this kind of merry-go-round of transfers and having all the talent spread out, is that people are seeing a few more opportunities actually to turn up and, you know, get a top 10 or get a podium or actually, you know, get a win, and a little bit less scared of, you know, kind of the SD Works mothership coming in and kind of ruining all of their best laid plans. So I think that we have kind of seen that, haven't we? We've seen a few more opportunistic wins this season, Becca.
Definitely. And it shows other riders that it is possible. And as you say, Denny, you know, there is that opportunity to take a chance and that it might pay off. And I think I agree that the real talking point there was not just that she took an exceptional victory, but actually watching her on the subsequent stage, she was phenomenal still. And I think just put up such a big fight. Yeah. And because I think so often we talk about an unexpected win as, oh, well, you know, this caveat and that, and that's why they got that. But I just think she was just really, really solid. And yeah, showed that in the following stage.
Yeah, definitely. I also wanted to give one more mention also to Celia Jerry, who is the a phenomenal domestique for FDJ Suez. I mean, just the strength and depth of that team is quite remarkable. The fact that they have such a strong team that's not just built around Demi Vollering, but can go to a race like Vuelta a Burgos when Vollering isn't there, and also kind of take the command in the peloton. Clearly, they're kind of trying to animate or, you know, decide basically how the race should be played. And they kind of use their team in numbers, don't they, at every opportunity. So phenomenal to see actually how strong they are. Celia Jerry, we saw a lot of her at Burgos, and you know, she is only 19 years old. She was doing junior races, winning junior races, I should say, over the last couple of years. But yeah, I just wanted to give her a big mention.
Yeah, I think this year has been a real year of actually seeing first time seniors, riders fresh out of the junior ranks, really kind of being on the same level as much of the Women's World Tour peloton, which is, you know, I know we've seen that trend to some extent on the men's side with kind of World Tour teams picking up junior riders straight from the junior ranks and kind of throwing them in at the deep end. But I think we're now seeing that in the women's side as well. I think last year Lidl Trek signed three juniors and we kind of all questioned, you know, that decision to kind of sign them up straight from the junior ranks. But this year, Imogen Wolf has been showing huge amounts of maturity, was brilliant in the Vuelta, kind of being a great lieutenant for Mariana Vos. Kat Ferguson, we mentioned already, and you say Celia Jury, who was a big rival to Ferguson last year and won the Flanders junior race, kind of showing that she can kind of compete against the very best. I think it feels to me that we're seeing a real kind of shift on the women's side there. And I know some people have questioned whether that's a good thing for riders to kind of be plucked straight from the junior ranks, whether they need a bit more development time and should be kind of having more of more time to, I guess, and less pressure really to develop themselves. But that's the trend we're seeing, and for some riders at least, and for some teams, it's certainly working.
Well, it's such a difficult conversation, isn't it, about whether it is too soon to be plunging people into that level of pressure. But I remember chatting to Kat Ferguson when she was sort of officially the youngest ever rider to be signed to the World Tour, wasn't she? And I go back to saying this, Rose, what on earth were we doing at 17, 18? Yeah. Definitely not being signed to the World Tour. But she's so mature, you know, whether that's media commitments, all the head she has going into technical finishes, she's clearly capable and ready for it. But yeah, it is another conversation whether we're seeing that shift for the better that riders are taking that pressure on at the age of sort of 17, 18, 19. But yeah, I mean, these riders are just so impressive in their capability to deal with it.
Well, let's hear from a couple of, not junior racers, but a couple of riders who are reasonably new to the road racing circuit. And that is Lara Gillespie of UAE ADQ and Mia Griffin of Roland. As I said at the top of the show, they're two Irish riders, track riders who are kind of just taking their first steps into becoming full-on road racers. So let's hear this month's mini feature. Think of Irish cycling and the names Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach are fabled. In more recent years, it's the likes of Dan Martin and Sam Bennett who have planted the flag for the Emerald Isle. But what of the women? Well, suddenly there's a new generation starting to make their presence known.
Just recently, I met a woman. She's in my local club, which is Barra Wheelers, which was my original club team that I started riding with. And she was like, "Oh, Mia, if I could go back, you're so lucky. You're living my dreams," she said. She said that people would look at her weird when she was out riding with the men, but now it's not seen like that. And I think, in a way, there's a lot of stigmas that had to be broken as well.
That was Mia Griffin, the Roland rider, Kilkenny native and former camogie player. More on camogie later. She's one of a growing cohort of Irish women pushing through to the pro ranks. She, along with her compatriot Lara Gillespie, now of Team UAE ADQ, were fast-tracked through to Ireland's track team for the Paris Olympics.
Yeah, it was really, really cool. Like, a lot of behind the scenes work was done to get there, to even get four female riders at world level came from a program of where coaches picked athletes from other sports, and it was like talent transfer program, and that's where it actually came from, because cycling is not a big sport in Ireland. A lot of our athletes go to Gaelic football or camogie or other sports, and so it was definitely all new for a lot of us. We didn't really have, you know, a whole generation to look up to. So, and we were always breaking our own records. But it was a really cool experience, and it taught me a lot. And yeah, we went through a lot. And to get there and say that we're the first women's team pursuit in general to go for Ireland was really cool.
The really striking thing about Lara and Mia, and the first Irish women's pursuit team to make the Olympics, is that Ireland still doesn't have a single indoor velodrome on its soil.
Like 400 metres or 400 and something metres. And that was my first experience of it. And like you go fast, you're sprinting, and it was like this adrenaline. I was like, oh, this is really cool. And then you get thrown into the European Championships with where you're on a steep velodrome. You're like, oh, golly, gosh, okay. And I did go on a training camp before in Mallorca, and that's where Cycling Ireland were based a lot in Mallorca, that we could use their track because no other big nation was based there, so the track time was cheaper, more available, blah blah blah. And all I remember was just saying fake it until you make it. I had no idea what I was doing, but I loved that, and like the adrenaline of it, and I had a really good coach and he was there, and it was just fun, and the group we were with, and I was, just had it in my head, like, yeah, of course I can still win something. I just always had this, like, self-belief, which was complete naivety.
Lara's self-belief, and obviously a fair sprinkling of talent, has shown itself this year, her first full season in the Women's World Tour, with a handful of top tens in the Spring Classics. While Mia's season has seen her pin on the race number as far afield as El Salvador, something she'd never have achieved in her first sport of camogie.
Basically, it's a 15-a-side game. Everyone is trying to score either goals or points, and goals are worth 3 points and a point's worth 1 point. And basically, it's quite a physical game. I would say similar to hockey, but in the air. Maybe more aggressive than hockey, because I feel like you're allowed to use your body a little bit more to shield the ball and to try and tackle people for the ball as well. But it is aggressive, and sometimes these days you got to be aggressive in this bunch. That's what I'm learning anyway.
Camogie may not be making its Olympic debut anytime soon, but Cycling Ireland saw that Mia had all the physical attributes required to compete on the world stage.
I think the hand-eye coordination is like useful when you're in sort of a, maybe a sprint in the bunch, because you're used to having to deal with spatial awareness and explosive power. I was 18. I started because there was a talent transfer program that was advertised through Cycling Ireland, where they wanted to bring people from other sports into cycling because we don't have so much numbers in the female peloton, maybe like 30, 40. So they wanted to bring more riders with the incentive of the Paris Olympics on the track. So I started and like was completely naive going into it and not really knowing what to expect, really. They tested us over 3 minutes and 6 seconds. And then I had like decent enough numbers. So they took me on anyway with 7 other girls at the start. And then we started by going to Mallorca and starting training on the track. And then it eventually was like cut down to 5 girls. And then some of them were Imogen Cotter, Orla Walsh, and then later on Alice Sharp and Kelly Murphy and Lara Gillespie were brought in.
Lara picks up the story of the track team's development.
We never raced in a bunch before we come from Ireland. There's like 10 girls maybe. So even racing in a bunch is a whole different experience. And I think I was just lucky that I had the psychological confidence to just go for it, because you can really go one or the other way.
So how many like races had you ever done on like an indoor velodrome before you turned up at the World Champs?
Not any real race. I did like one day in Alkmaar with a really nice group of girls. And we did like a training race, you know, like with the Irish girls that were there. Obviously, none of us had ever done a real race before. So, yeah, I was just getting thrown in the deep end. But I also like that. No one's expecting me to win right now. So that's the fun of it.
Because we trained together all the time, and because we had a really good trainer there in Brian Nugent, who introduced me to the sport and who is the reason why I do the sport as well. And then a lot of us were trained by a guy called Tommy Evans, who lives in Northern Ireland. And he was a really good coach and really the reason why we sticked at cycling for so many years as well, through all the ups and downs, because we had a lot of adversity as well to go through with changing coaches and a period of time where we had no coach for the track team, where we were kind of in an interim where all the girls were in Mallorca, but we had no coach with the Team Pursuit squad. So it's actually really nice to look back and see kind of what those people built as well from the ground up, having so little girls. But just like, I think in Ireland as well, we don't have many riders, but in a way you have to protect what you've got. And it's really nice that they invested so much in us so that we could have all the experience in the big races and we could be trained and looked after. And I think that kind of shows how talent in a way is overrated, when you can take a small group, and if you put enough into them of time and investment, then it can come back with some really nice things as well.
The margins at the top of elite sport are small. Ireland's women finished 9th on Olympic debut, but not far off 8th place, which would have qualified them for another ride. And who knows what place from there?
Yeah, it was really mixed feelings, I would say, the Olympics. It was a nice experience. And it was just crazy because everyone went so fast that we did a huge PB and then we came off the track and we're like, oh, that was so great. But then we were 9th and like, I think 0.2 off qualifying for the top 8 to get another ride. So it was something that was just, it was over like so quickly after so much preparation. So it was really hard to fathom the fact that you've spent years to prepare for this event, and nearly all my cycling lifetime I prepared for this few minutes of racing, which was just over in the blink of an eye.
Of course, the Olympic experience wasn't the end, but more of a prologue to the riders' stories today. Laura gained a contract with Team UAE ADQ coming up from their development squad, and her confidence has been backed by results that can't be ignored. You're on the podium in some of the semi-classics. You're very close to being on the podium in like World Tour races. Are you thinking, right, one day there will be pressure? Do you think you'll always be able to kind of sustain that kind of chilled attitude to it?
Probably it will change. And that's a good thing if it changes, because that means I'm like a reliable leader or a reliable winner. It's a whole process. And I think that's like a whole learning process that I have to go through. It also happened this year on the track for me, where I was like not able to race how I wanted to race because I had people on my wheel or people really watching or not letting me do the attacks that I would normally be allowed to, you know, go on. And that was so frustrating for me. So yeah, it is definitely a whole psychological thing of, okay, how do I race if people are watching, or if, I'm not a surprise person anymore.
These history makers still have plenty more to achieve for themselves and for Ireland, the opportunity they have to inspire others back home to follow in their wheel tracks.
Social media can be important in that you're showing these girls what you're doing and the cool races and World Cups and everything that you get to go to, and they're like, oh, I want to not work or go to college for now, and I want to go to those World Cups, like to give it as even an option.
Hello, Ned Bolting here. If you, like me, think that the journey is just as important as the destination, then can I interest you in my latest book, The Accidental Tourist? This memoir spreads its wings beyond the confines of just the Tour de France, as a quarter century of covering cycling takes me all around the world, following skinny men and women racing bikes very fast. There's chapters on life at the Giro, the growth of women's racing, and memories of Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish. The Accidental Tourist is out now and available from all good bookshops and audiobook retailers.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Well, that was this month's mini feature with Laura Gillespie and Mia Griffin. Two names that I hope that we're going to be seeing a lot more of soon in the coming, well, maybe even next week, because actually Laura Gillespie is doing the Tour of Britain Women. And as we always know with the Tour of Britain Women, or the Women's Tour as it was, there's an awful lot of sprinting, an awful lot of fast finishes on offer. We should say, actually, it's great to see that the Tour of Britain Women is still going, because it was so close to never existing again, wasn't it, last year? And the fact that British Cycling taking it on and managing to still stage it is great. It's clearly growing a bit this year than from what it was last year, where it kind of was put together right at the last minute, wasn't it? And it was a lot of Conti teams, a lot of the World Tour teams didn't make it across to race it. So Denny, obviously with your British continental eye on it, you'll be able to tell us something of what we should expect from the Tour of Britain Women. Don't just say a load of fast finishes.
No, there won't be just a load of fast finishes. It's four stages. Of course, as you expect, it's not, you know, it's not covering the breadth and depth of the country. So there's always people saying, you know, complaining that it's not a real tour. But with four stages, you cannot go across the whole of the UK. But there's a couple of kind of flattish stages, but a couple of really punchy stages too. Stage two finishes on Saltburn Bank, which to domestic road racing fans is becoming a bit of an iconic finish. It's been the finish to the national road race the last couple of years, and features in a key domestic race too. So that should be a good one to watch. And stage three is on a course in Scotland, which is particularly lumpy. So again, those two stages would be the stages I expect to see the kind of big GC differences. The final stage is just a circuit race within Glasgow, and unfortunately it's not the world's course. It's a very flat course, so they're not using the kind of sharp punchy climbs that they used in the World or the Commonwealth Games previously. But it's a kind of varied course, so it should make for some interesting racing. I spoke to John Dutton, the CEO of British Cycling, last year, just after BC had come in and saved the race. He said his ambition for this year was for the race to reach race day parity with the Tour of Britain men, which currently has 6 stages. But this year, still only 4 stages. Not clear on the reasons why. I don't know if that's a sign of BC still trying to get sufficient resources, funds, interest from local authorities into kind of organising a longer stage race. That's not clear yet, but it should be, you know, should offer some fun racing. None of the major stage racing stars will be there, but we will have riders like Rowena Wiebes, Kristen Faulkner, Elisa Balsamo coming. So, you know, some of the world's best sprinters, the Olympic road race champions. So still a strong field. And of course, with my British Continental hat on as well, a very strong British presence there. 5 UCI Continental teams from Britain and a Great Britain team. So it's a race that will provide a lot of opportunities for teams that otherwise wouldn't get that level of exposure.
And a great opportunity for you to get your little Union Jack bowler hat out, Denny, isn't it? And your three-piece suit.
Yes. In the Union Jack.
Please tell me you have one.
Well, I'll keep that one a secret for now.
only when you're on British Continental duty.
Yes, yeah.
You have to put on the whole garb.
Yeah, great opportunity to taste some great British cheeses along the way, though.
Oh, gosh. Don't get into the cheeses now, Denny. Come on, we're still months away from the Tour de France. Fam, I mean, I know actually it's kind of a little bit much maligned, isn't it? The Women's Tour, I was kind of flippantly saying about how many fast finishes there are. But it is important that we do have races for all types of riders because, you know, the high mountains they always the fan favourite, aren't they, the high mountains? And in recent years, they have come to a little bit monopolise all of the stage racing. So it's actually important that we do have these bumpy, lumpy and sprinty type stages, and it's a good opportunity, isn't it, Becca? We've got Charlotta Kuhl will be there, and Lorena Wiebes and Elisa Balsamo, trying to, you know, see. I mean, we kind of think that we know that Lorena Wiebes has any just flat finish in the bag, and probably also any on a ramp as well, actually, if I'm totally honest. Yeah. And probably up the hill and down the hill and in all the other ways. But it'll be good to see where we stand with the sprint contenders, won't it? To get a little bit of an insight into that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. And yeah, looking down the start list as it stands at the moment, provisionally, there is some really exciting sprint talent in there. You've just mentioned Charlotte Kuhl going up against Wiebes, so we'll see that sort of comparison. And yeah, I do like a sprinty finish. But I think when we look at last year, when we were kind of appraising the return of the race, I think we all agreed it was absolutely critical. We had it on the calendar. Some people were saying, why are there not more stages? But as Denny says, I think the plan from British Cycling is that year on year, we'll just sustainably see that grow and we'll just see stages added year on year. That's what I expect anyway. And I think looking at last year, it was something like 100 days to go that they had to take that handover and make the race happen. So yeah, I think we're all in agreement, aren't we? It's just a brilliant opportunity to have it on the calendar. And we just hope it's a race that we see diversify, grow, become, you know, level with the men in terms of stages. And yeah, span more interesting parts of the country.
And it is great also to have these, I don't want to say second tier World Tour races, but it is great to have a World Tour race, which does allow for some of the smaller, does allow for, you know, not even just the smaller teams to kind of make their mark, but even some of the riders on the big teams to make their mark. There's, you know, plenty of riders who have to devote most of their racing time to riding to the benefit of others, and they don't actually have many opportunities to kind of just give it a crack and maybe get a World Tour win. But I do feel like the Tour of Britain women does offer that opportunity, doesn't it?
It's absolutely really important to have races like that. And if every race was just a kind of stage race designed as a warm-up for the Tour de France fam, that would be to the detriment of women's cycling, I think. So it is important, and it is a strong field just because we don't have the big stage racing riders there. That's not to say it's not a strong field. It's much, certainly the race, the depth of the race will be a lot stronger this year. Last year, there was very little in the way of World Tour presence because it had been arranged so late and so many teams had made other plans. But this year, we do have a really strong World Tour lineup. And, you know, you mentioned the kind of the sprint power that we've got there. But yeah, it is really important. I mean, I remember last year, Ruby Roseman-Gannon won her first World Tour race on a stage there. And that was a big moment for her. And, you know, for riders from the UCI Continental teams, you know, getting a 10th place or, you know, kind of getting their first chance to ride alongside Lorena Wiebes and Elisa Balsamo and Charlotte Tocul and kind of see how they fare in a sprint out against some of those riders is a really important development opportunity as well, regardless of what result they get. So these are really important races, and I'm glad that we do see these different parkour. And I think that hopefully the course is varied enough that we will have some suspense, some excitement along the way too. It was not just a case of you know, waiting for sprints at the end of every stage.
And then we're going to, of course, have the Tour de Suisse, which is often a fantastic race for kind of seeing how everyone's faring. I know, Rebecca, you've been on top of the start list, haven't you?
I have been doing some extensive research, and I'm currently looking at the preliminary start list on Pro Cycling Stats. Marlon Reusser is one of the only confirmed riders, so I think she's going to definitely do well. I'm scrolling down. Is there anybody else on my sheet? Blanca Vass as well. She'll be there. There you go.
Oh, well, Blanca Vass is bound to kind of take it right at the end, isn't she, of the Marlon Reusser victory parade. But no, Tour de Suisse, obviously a lot more kind of climby, but does also have that kind of same element of the Tour of Britain women, doesn't it? That it kind of can be a bit of a launch pad for riders and, you know, give opportunities to riders when they otherwise wouldn't have it. So that's all to come. That's actually, we're going to be actually back really soon, because I did squeeze this episode in just before June. It does mean that we'll be back in probably about 2 weeks or something like that. And we'll be talking about the Tour de Suisse and, of course, about the Tour of Britain women. Will we be able to find a cabana for us all to meet up in for that race? Rebecca, what's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
On cabana watch.
I was hoping you'd find the cabana, but I'll happily take the baton.
To be honest, though, we should be looking for a Swiss chalet, shouldn't we?
I was going to say, I think we've missed the boat on that one.
Does the cycling podcast budget stretch to jetting us out down to the Alps?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, the budget does. It's just that I spend all the budget on sitting on piles of cash. That's how I spend all of the Feminine budget. Yeah. That's why we definitely have the budget to do it. It's just that
if
I'm just
the Zoom
not
camera
willing
panned down to... right now, we'd see you literally sitting on piles and piles of notes.
and of course, you've got to fund the Ninka Finka fan club for me with my shiny notebook as well.
Yes, I've got to fund that. I've got to fund Denny's outrageously large Casio Niviadoma calculator. I should have said your crystal balls there, Denny. That sounded like I was setting up. Those cost a lot of money as well. The endless buffing and shining of those crystal balls is really a drain on the cycling podcast Feminine funds. Well, if we do find the money even have you guys back on the episode next month, then I do hope that the listeners will join us for that as well. But for now, I better let you get off to your buffing and shining, Denny.
Need to get them insured as well, Denny.
Like oh, it, gosh, yeah. Yes. You would be nothing without them. You really would be nothing without them. So thank you very much, Denny Gray. And Rebecca, I can't bear to think about where the Ninka Vinka fan club funds will get spent, but after her recent fantastic performances. But thank you very much for joining us, Rebecca.
Thanks so much.
And thank you, listeners.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.